It's time for, excuse me, Bigler's World for the next hour. This is Jim Bigler. What do I got here? I got some National Geographic for kids. That's always a crowd pleaser. Maybe some Ranger Rick. Haven't done that in a little while, I don't think. Let's do some science news, little Time magazine for kids. Why don't we start out with newsforkids.net? This is an interesting one. Book found wrapped in ancient King Arthur story. And then it says Cambridge, England. Scientists working at the Cambridge University Library have discovered a lost story from the Middle Ages about King Arthur and Merlin. The story was hiding in plain sight. It had been used as a book cover. Now scientists have carefully unfolded the book cover digitally, revealing the hidden story. In 2019, an old book that listed property records caught the eye of Dr. Irene Fabry Terachi. The book dated from the 1500s, but it looked even older. Okay, the cover was parchment, made from animal skin, and was folded around the book and stitched onto it. Old French handwriting covered the parchment. By studying the cover, Dr. Fabry Terachi learned that the writing was about King Arthur and the wizard Merlin. It was part of the old French story that came after the story of King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. The French tale is known as the Suite Vulgate du Merlin. Say that three times fast. There were fewer than 40 manuscripts, handwritten copies of this story. Each copy is different because they were all written by hand. The colors and the writing style helped the scientists figure out that the book's cover was created between 1275 and 1315. The book's cover was clearly of great interest, but the parchment was old and fragile. The writing on it had been rubbed off in some places. Worst of all, most of the writing on the parchment was hidden. Scientists at the library worried that the parchment would get damaged if it were removed. Removing it would also ruin the book it was covering, which was also of historical interest. The researchers decided to try to digitally unfold the parchment. They took high-quality photos of the parchment using light of different wavelengths. These images revealed detail that hadn't been noticed before. The team then used a CT, computed tomography scanner, to take 3D X-ray images of the book. This led to a 3D model which allowed the scientists to see how the parchment was folded and sewn into the book. Once they understood this, the researchers were able to use special equipment to take even more pictures of all the different parts of the cover, even the hidden ones. Then, by carefully putting all these pieces together, the team created a digital image of what the cover would look like if it were unfolded. Dr. Fabry Terachi said, "It's like solving a puzzle." The scientists were now able to read everything written on the parchment. They learned that the parchment told two stories. One was about the battle in which Arthur's nephew, Sir Gawain, fought with his magic sword Excalibur. The other story was about Merlin appearing to King Arthur disguised as a blind musician. Later, in battle, Merlin turns King Arthur's flag into a dragon. Happens every day. The five-year effort wasn't just about uncovering these King Arthur stories. No, no. Dr. Fabry Terachi says the project helped the researchers develop new methods of studying old documents that are easily damaged and have hidden surfaces. They think their methods will help libraries around the world unlock even more secrets hidden in the fragile documents. Next up on Bigler's World, let's go to Dogo News for Kids. Researchers may have found a new color, and we need it. Just when it seemed every color under the sun had been named, researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, have identified a new one called OLO, O-L-O. This shade lies outside the normal range of human vision. It can only be seen under specific conditions using a laser. The five people who have seen OLO describe it as a blue-green of unprecedented saturation. Before exploring how OLO can be seen, it's helpful to understand how humans perceive color. The human retina contains three types of cone cells, each sensitive to different wavelengths of light. L cones detect long wavelengths, that's red. M cones, they respond to medium wavelengths, those are the greens. And the S cones pick up short wavelengths, those are the blues. While each cone is most sensitive to its main color, it also responds to nearby colors on the spectrum. The M cones, which detect green light, sit in the middle. Because of this, when green light activates the M cones, some of the light often spills over and partially activates the L and S cones, too. It's like pouring water into the middle of three side-by-side cups and seeing a bit of splash into the ones on either side. This overlap helps the brain blend colors and lets us see thousands of different shades. Let's see, who is this talking? Study co-author Ren Ing says, "There is no light in the world that can activate only the M cone cells, because if they are being activated, for sure one or both other types get activated as well." The researchers wondered what would happen if they could turn on just the M cone without affecting the others. To try this, they built a special device called Oz, as in O-Z. It uses a very precise laser to activate just one cone cell in the eye. Ing explains, "The name comes from The Wizard of Oz, where there's a journey to the Emerald City where things look the most dazzling green you've ever seen." The team recruited five people to test Oz. Three, including Ing, were part of the research team and knew its purpose. The other two were outsiders with no knowledge of the study's goals. This helped ensure that their opinions were not influenced. The scientists began by mapping the individual cone cells in each participant's retina. They then used Oz to stimulate only the M cones and asked the participants to describe what they saw. All five reported seeing a green color that was more vivid and saturated than anything found in the natural world. No digital display can reproduce the exact shade, but the closest approximation was an intense teal or bluish green. The study's findings, published in the Journal of Science Advances back April 18th of 2025, have sparked global interest among researchers. Andrew Stockman, a vision scientist at the University College London, believes the discovery could one day help people with red-green color blindness experience normal vision. However, John Berber at the University of London is not convinced that OLO is a new color. He believes it is just a very bright green that shows up when the M cones are the only ones receiving light. Next article. Here on Bigler's World, sticking with Dogo News, get ready for Mother's Day, it commands us. Daksha Morjaria wrote this particular article. On May 11th, 2025, most Americans will celebrate Mother's Day. The beloved tradition is credited to Anna Jarvis, a teacher from Philadelphia. She wanted to honor the sacrifices mothers make for their families. The first celebration took place in 1908 at a church in Grafton, West Virginia. It was such a success that Jarvis launched a campaign to make Mother's Day a national holiday. Her efforts paid off in 1914 when President Woodrow Wilson signed a proclamation making the second Sunday in May Mother's Day. Jarvis envisioned a simple celebration. It involved wearing a white carnation and visiting one's mother or attending a church service. But after the holiday became official, retailers quickly began promoting gifts and products tied to Mother's Day. Jarvis spent years fighting this trend. She even filed lawsuits against what she called profiteers. By the time she died in 1948, Jarvis had disowned the holiday and had worked hard that she had worked hard to create. Mother's Day has since become increasingly commercial. It is now the country's third largest retail holiday after the winter holiday and back-to-back school season. The National Retail Federation, or the NRF, estimates that 84% of Americans will observe the holiday this year. They will each spend about $259 for the staggering total of $34.1 billion. This is up slightly from $33.5 billion in 2024 and just shy of the record, which was back in 2023 at $35.7 billion spent on Mother's Day. Well, on mothers, greeting cards and flowers top the list of popular gifts, but they account for a small portion of the total amount spent. The large chunk, $6.8 billion, will be spent on jewelry. About $6 billion will go towards special outings like dinner or brunch. Other favorites include gift cards, electronics, clothing, and personal services like spa treatments or massages. While the gifts are appreciated, most mothers would rather spend quality time with their families and get a break from daily chores. So this May, it commands us to do something thoughtful, like serving her breakfast in bed. More importantly, set aside your phone and give your mom the full attention she deserves. Okay, let's do one more article from Dogo News. Before moving along, Philadelphia Zoo celebrates birth of critically endangered tortoises, says Alvaro Aragon, who wrote this article. On April 23rd, 2025, the Philadelphia Zoo introduced four female hatchlings of the critically endangered Western Santa Cruz Galapagos tortoises, turtles, to the public. The new arrivals were named Dorothy, Rose, Blanche, and Sophia, after the characters in the iconic television series The Golden Girls. They are the first of their kind to be born at the zoo in its 150-year history. Prior to this, there were only 44 Western Santa Cruz tortoises in the U.S. zoos, including three in Philadelphia. The tortoises are the offspring of two of the zoo's most senior residents, Mommy and Abrazo, both nearly a century old. Mommy is also the oldest known first-time mother of her species. Fittingly, the hatchlings made their public debut on the 93rd anniversary of their arrival at the zoo. Let's see, who is this talking? Zoo president and CEO, Dr. Joe L. Mogerman, says this:
Mommy arrived at the zoo in 1932, meaning anyone that has visited the zoo for the past 92 years has likely seen her. Philadelphia's zoo vision is that those hatchlings will be part of a thriving population of Galapagos tortoises on our healthy planet 100 years from now. Thank you very much.
Mommy weighed just 40 pounds when she arrived from the Galapagos Islands. Today, at around 97 years old, she tips the scale at 284 pounds. She is considered to be one of the most genetically valuable tortoises, since her origins can be traced back to her native habitat. Abrazo, now 96, arrived at the zoo in 2020 as part of a breeding program and was introduced to Mommy soon after. Since 2023, Mommy laid three clutches of eggs, but none hatched. She finally had success with her fourth clutch of 16 eggs laid in November of 2024. The gender of Galapagos tortoise hatchlings is determined by incubation temperature. That's clever. To ensure a mix, zoo staff set half the eggs below 81.86 degrees Fahrenheit. It's got to be 81.86. To produce males, and the other half above 88.8 to produce females. The first egg hatched on February 27th, followed by three more. All four hatchlings so far are female. The young tortoises will remain at the zoo for at least 5 years. After that, researchers will decide whether to send them to the Galapagos Islands or other zoos. This will depend on whether they are suitable mates at another zoo. As for Mommy, she may live another 100 years, so more hatchlings could still be in her future. Galapagos tortoises are the largest living species of tortoise. Males can reach 6 feet long and weigh over 500 pounds, while females average about 250 pounds. Native to the Galapagos Islands, these gentle giants can live between 100 and 200 years old. Once found in abundance, Galapagos tortoises populations have been decimated by habitat loss, overhunting, and introduction of predators. Today, 13 species, comprising about 20,000 individuals, live on the islands. This is a big improvement from the 1970s, when only about 3,000 remained. One of the rarest is the Western Santa Cruz tortoise, with only around 3,400 living in the wild. It is no wonder that the addition of four hatchlings is such a cause for celebration. Okay, let's head on over to Frontiers for Young Minds. This is entitled, this article, Wearables, there it is, to help grandparents find their way in the city. Angelique Mantui wrote this article. It goes like this: Finding our way as we get older. Did you know that these days people are living longer and healthier lives than they did in the past? Did you know that? That means that you spend more time with your grandparents doing many fun things together. But have you ever noticed that your grandparents get stressed when you go somewhere new with them. For example, you may want to go to a park to see some amazing animals, but your grandparents have never been there before. They might feel stressed because they have difficulty finding their way to a new place. Wayfinding, that's one word, wayfinding, is like having a kind of GPS in your head. A human-based GPS that uses your senses, like your eyes and ears and some of your brain's skills, to help you find your way. But for older people, the internal GPS might not work very well. For instance, you might have already observed your grandparents experiencing problems seeing or hearing things. Also, their brain skills like memory and attention could be diminished compared to when they were younger. All of this affects their wayfinding ability and could cause them to avoid going places they do not know well. Oh, yes. Older people often use paper maps to find their way around, but paper maps are hard to read and they represent the world from above, the way birds would see it. This is called allocentric representation. Older people usually prefer a first-person representation of their environment, like signs telling them to turn left or right, or pictures of the places. This is called ergocentric representation. For this reason, our research team has been interested in creating new types of aids to support older people's wayfinding. These aids should provide them with ergocentric information to find their destinations. Also, we want to ensure that people will get the information, so we have used several senses, their eyes, ears, and skin, to see which would be best. Designing efficient and pleasant wearables. Technologies like Google Maps can be effective ways to help people find their way. Maybe you've already tried it. It tells you where to turn, that's ergocentric information, to get from where you are to your destination. But there are at least two problems with Google Maps. First, it is usually used on a small smartphone screen, so it's hard for older people to read. For this reason, we should think about other ways to give them the information. Second, if people are too focused on the app, they might pay less attention to what is around them. This could be very dangerous for old people, especially in cities with lots of traffic. Also, if people pay less attention to their surroundings, they do not learn about the new place they are visiting. For this reason, we should design aids that limit the need for attention sharing. We propose wearable technologies. Wearables are technologies that people wear on their bodies so they do not have to keep a smartphone in hand and share their attention. There are several types of wearables. Smartwatches are the most common ones. They vibrate and they can show basic information on a screen on the wearer's wrist. We could also use augmented reality glasses, or AR. These are newer technologies which directly show information in front of the wearer's eyes. We created AR sunglasses because it might be sunny outdoors. Headphones could help with wayfinding too, but they might be dangerous because wearers might not hear what happens around them. For this reason, we tried bone conduction headphones made of small vibrators placed on the bone between the eyes and the ears. The brain perceives the vibration on the bone as a sound. What information can reach of these wearables give? Well, we said ergocentric information, make left turn or right turn, is more efficient for older people compared to a paper map. There are several ways to tell someone to turn somewhere. You can write it down, say it, draw an arrow, or make a sound,
etc.
We used green flashing arrows and high-pitched sounds in the left or right ears. These were previously tested in a virtual environment to be sure that they would be easily caught and understood by older people. So our wearables were, you got a smartwatch that vibrates to indicate the person should turn and displays a green arrow pointing in the right direction. AR sunglasses displaying an arrow indicating when and where people should turn. And finally, a bone conduction headset beeping on the left or the right when people should turn. Let's see what we got here. We were also concerned about the user experience. Older people may be used to paper maps, and it's not easy to change habits, so we wanted to ensure that the wearables were proposed would be acceptable to them. To measure the user experience, we asked people what they thought and observed them doing an experiment in Paris, of all places, doing tests in the city. We asked 18 people, ages 60 to 77, to test the three wearables. We also ask them to bring the aid they usually use to find their way, either a paper map or a smartphone, because we wanted to compare their user experiences between the methods. We asked them to take 4 walks in Paris, one with each aid. Each walk was 1 kilometer long. Don't know how long that is, but it's a kilometer. For each walk, we measured the time it took to reach their destination and the number of errors they made. Uh-oh. During each walk, each person wore a hat with a camera on it to help us understand what they pay attention to. We followed the participants all the time, so if they had a problem with the information provided by the wearable, we were there to help. They could also talk to us and give their permission of what was going on, their impression. At the end of each walk, we rested. During this pause, we asked the participants questions to get their user experience. Then, in our laboratory, we analyzed all the data we collected. We watched the videos from the cameras and wrote down all the things that were said during the walks and the pauses. We also did some mathematical analysis, or statistics, on the errors and the time needed to reach each destination. Insights from the study. The first interesting thing we learned from our study is that most people brought paper maps as their usual aid for wayfinding. That was 16 out of 18 of them. That confirms that older people are really used to these. When comparing the time to reach the destination of the walk, it took participants longer with the map than with the wearables. On average, with the map, people took 50% more time than expected. For a 10-minute walk, it took them an average of 15 minutes with a map, compared to 12 minutes with the wearables. This means that the paper map is truly less efficient than the wearables. When comparing the errors that were made with each aid, the AR sunglasses were the worst. What a surprising result. On average, people made errors in the direction they walked about 5% of the time, but the rate of errors was almost 20% with the AR sunglasses. Most participants said they had issues seeing the arrows in the AR sunglasses, either because the arrows were too small or too short. So they had to focus their attention closely on a very small spot where the arrow was displayed instead of looking around. They also had difficulty interpreting the arrows. Should they turn here or there? Information was easier to understand with the two other wearables, the smartwatch and the bone conduction headset. Analysis of the videos showed that people had more attention issues when they used maps than the wearables. On the videos, we saw that many participants almost walked into objects in their surroundings because they were looking at their maps while they were walking. What about the user experience? Participants liked using the bone conduction headset and the smartwatch. They said they would like to use these wearables because they work well, can be trusted, and are discreet. With the AR sunglasses, user experience was bad because people found it unpleasant to be so focused on trying to understand the information. They thought the glasses were too obvious and might make them look like they were blind. In conclusion, even if older people still use paper maps, some of the wearables we have proposed open up new possibilities for helping them find their way in the city more easily. In the future, you might see your grandparents wearing headsets and smartwatches to go to new places more easily. We must keep in mind that technologies evolve very quickly, so maybe new types of AR glasses will be more efficient in the future. Okay, let's go to another magazine. Right here on Bigler's World, on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Okay, let's do some National Geographic Kids. 5 reasons why bats are the best. Oh yes, you'll want to go to bat for these awesome mammals after reading about their super cool skills, says Andrea Selen. Okay, 1, bats keep insects from bugging you. I knew about this one at least. These flying mammals eat up lots of pesky insects. In fact, the little brown bat from North America pictured above here, he's so cute, can gulp more than 1,200 mosquitoes in 1 hour. Without bats around, you might have a lot more annoying bites. 2, they have superhero hearing. Bats have special cells in their ears that make them extremely sensitive to noise. The hearing ability of some bats is so strong they can detect the sound of a beetle walking on a leaf. Well, I can do that. 3, the mammal comes in all sizes. You got one here. The face looks like a fox or something. Is that a fox? A kitty hognose bat. Over 1,000 bats species exist, from tiny to titanic. A kitty's long-nosed bat from Southeast Asia weighs about the same as a dime. Meanwhile, the Malaysian flying fox, there it is, pictured above, can weigh 2 pounds and has a 6-foot-long wingspan. That is creepy. That is scary stuff. Number four, they can give you a thumbs up. Bats have thumbs. Shaped like hooks, the thumbs stick out from the top edge of the bat's wings. The animals use their thumbs to cling to trees and for eating. And finally, number five, the animals like big parties. Bats hang out in groups called colonies. In the summer, Bracken Cave in New Braunfels, Texas, is home to a colony of more than 20 million free-tailed bats. And during warmer months, one bridge in Austin, Texas, they got a picture of it here, is a hangout spot for 1.5 million free-tailed bats. There's a bunch of people on the bridge looking at these bats flying around in big colonies. Next article from National Geographic Kids. Whale shark. These enormous fish are found in tropical oceans around the world. I thought sharks weren't fish. Laura Gertzel wrote this article. A whale shark the size of a school bus swims slowly near the surface of the ocean. Its wide mouth is open like an enormous net, scooping up whatever happens to be around, mostly small fish, fish eggs, and plants. As the world's largest fish, this won't be a short trip. No, no. A whale shark needs to travel about 5,000 miles each year to find enough food. Oh, I guess it's not a mammal. It's a shark. What was I thinking? Okay, the common name is the whale shark. The scientific name is Rhynchondon typus. It's a fish. It's a carnivore. The group name, school. Average lifespan in the wild, 70 years. That's impressive. The size, also impressive, 18 to 32.8 feet. And they weigh 20.6 tons, I guess on average. Filter feeding. Whale sharks spend nearly 8 hours a day gulping around 10,000 gallons of ocean water at nearly 40 feet long. They seem like they could eat whatever they want, but they're really after plankton, microscopic plants, and animals. The opening of whale shark's throat is covered with about 20 giant pads that have hundreds of tiny holes. As the seawater goes in, these pads filter out the food, sort of like a colander catching spaghetti, while the cooking water drains out. Then the water escapes through the shark's gills, and the food is pushed down its throat. Scientists have also observed the whale sharks eating while standing up in areas with lots of prey, like large schools of anchovies or other small fish. With its tail pointed towards the ocean floor and its mouth toward the surface, the shark opens and closes its massive 4-foot-wide mouth to create suction. The pressure pulls in the surrounding water along with the fish. Gentle giants. Although whale sharks are the third biggest creature in the ocean after blue whales and fin whales, they are not aggressive and don't threaten humans. In fact, researchers and divers often swim right next to them, and the sharks don't mind a bit. Whale sharks mostly swim and feed alone, but scientists have observed them hunting with other species of fish between March and August in Western Australia's Ningaloo Reef. This is when whale sharks, as well as predators like tuna and other sharks, and even birds, arrive for a plankton buffet caused by coral spawning and egg laying. Smaller fish try to avoid the predators by swimming in a big ball for protection. That might work against some predators, but the massive mouthed whale shark easily gulps up the fish. Spot 'em. Each whale has a unique pattern of spots and stripes, sort of like your fingerprints. These patterns help scientists track their movements as they migrate through tropical waters, including along the coasts of South Africa, Western Australia, Thailand, and Mexico. Like all sharks, whale sharks don't have bones. Their skeletons are made of cartilage, the same stuff found in human ears and noses. Cartilage is strong, flexible, and less dense than bone, so it helps the sharks swim fast and use less energy. Preserving populations. Adult whale sharks have no known natural predators, though blue marlin and blue sharks prey on younger ones. Humans are the biggest threat to these endangered fish, which are illegally hunted and sold as food and can be injured by large shipping vessels. Although their rubbery skin can be more than 5 inches thick, whale sharks can still be injured when fishing boats crash into them. Their ocean habitat is also threatened by pollution. But thanks in part to protected areas where it's against the law to harm whale sharks, scientists hope to see their numbers rise. These protected regions include Australia, India, the Philippines, and the United States. Scientists are also tagging and tracking the giant fish to learn more about their migration and breeding habits. Learning about whale sharks is an important part of protecting them. Okay, and they got some fun facts. Whale sharks have tiny teeth that cover their eyeballs, probably to protect the peepers from harsh ocean habitat. One fish had over 3,000 teeth around its iris. Next, the older known whale shark is 50 years old. That's the oldest, not older, but researchers think the fish might live up to 100 years. A whale shark's mouth has over 3,000 super small teeth. We already did that. They're arranged in more than 300 rows. Okay, they didn't say that. And that ends the article, I guess. And let's do one more article here in National Geographic before moving on. Right here on Begler's World. Moment of Rabbit is the name of this article. Beware, it says. These pictures are irresistible. This cute little bunny here. Rabbits live on every continent except Antarctica. I wonder why, including 29 species of wild rabbits and about 50 breeds of domestic bunnies. These perky-eared mammals are excellent at listening for predators and then leaping away on their strong hind legs. Ready to meet a few rabbits? And it commands me to hop to it. Allison Shaw wrote this. Let's see. For these hoppers, the floor is lava, very old. I guess it's this picture they're talking about. And dried and cool lava, by the way. The volcano rabbits live only on the upper slopes of 4 extinct volcanoes near Mexico City. That's in Mexico, by the way. Who knew bunnies could be so extreme? Totally extreme. Okay, they got one bunny in the wild here. All pet bunnies are descended from one species. I did not know that. The European rabbit. These wild jumpers are found on all continents except Asia and Antarctica, often living alongside humans in parks, gardens, lawns, and farms. Which is kind of a standard rabbit. It doesn't have super long ears, so it's not a jackrabbit. Oh, this is cute. The pygmy rabbit from the western states lives up to its name. An adult weighs as much as a soda can and can fit in the palm of a scientist's hand. He's all round. Cute and round. How about riverine rabbits? They live alongside rivers in the Karoo Desert in South Africa. The special soil that is deposited by the river water is a perfect place to build burrows and to rest and hide in. This one has some longer ears than the other ones, but they're all kind of gray and brown mixed in together. Named for their cotton ball-like tails, eastern cottontail rabbits can zig and zag up to 18 miles an hour. Some scientists think the bright tails confuse predators. The white fuzz disappears as the bunny jumps from one direction to the other. That's my technique. That's my move. This one looks like a capybara. A-M-A-M-I. Amami rabbits are one of the oldest surviving bunny species, living only on the Amami and Tokuno Islands off the coast of Japan. These nocturnal rabbits have stout bodies, dark fur, and small ears. And they look a little like a capybara. And let's see, is this the last one? Yeah. Around the 1800s, people began keeping domestic rabbits. Around the 1800s, they began keeping domestic rabbits as companions. Intelligent and social animals, these pets need lots of exercise, play, and attention. And, there's one more article. I'm going to do one more article in National Geographic Kids. Yesterday was Cinco de Mayo. The name of this article is Cinco de Mayo Fiesta Fun. Check out the surprising facts about this celebration. I will. I'm a day late, but I don't care. Who wrote this? Rose Davidson. You might hear about Cinco de Mayo parties, but even though celebrations of Cinco de Mayo, which translates to the 5th of May, is that when it is? Originated in Mexico. The day is more popular in the United States. So what does Cinco de Mayo celebrate? Well, on the morning of May 5th, 1862, 6,000 French troops stormed the Mexican city of Heroica Puebla de Zaragoza to bring it under French rule. The Mexican soldiers were outnumbered, but they fiercely fought back. By early evening, the French had retreated, and they were eating croissants. Now the people of Puebla, Mexico, observe the holiday, Cinco de Mayo, to celebrate this victory. The holiday is also widely celebrated in the United States. Americans use the celebration to honor the battle as well as Mexican culture. And then there's the margaritas. In the United States, people attend parades with colorfully dressed dancers, listen to lively Mexican folk music called mariachi, and eat millions of avocados in traditional eats such as guacamole. Washington, D.C. even holds the running of the Chihuahuas. I did not know that. Where the Chihuahuas, a breed that originated in Mexico, of all places, race each other for fun. Cinco de Mayo might be celebrated on the fifth day in May, but it gets a 10 on the fun scale. Positively 10. Okay, they got a picture of some women dancing. Colorful parades are part of the Cinco de Mayo celebration in the United States. They got some mariachis, these guys here. Mexican folk music is often heard here. And then there's every year people eating millions of avocados and foods like guacamole, a traditional Mexican dish. They got a picture of the Mexican flag here. Is that an eagle on it? I forget. It doesn't say what's on it. And then there's a chihuahua running to the cameraman. They race each other for fun. They raise money for charity during the running of the Chihuahuas in Washington, D.C. Okay, that's it. Okay, let us go over to Time for Kids. That's right, it's Time Magazine for Kids. Allergies Strike is the name of this article by Lillian Stone. Allergy season is here. Did you know that? Seasonal allergies affect nearly one quarter of kids in the United States, per the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. Many experience symptoms in the spring when plants release pollen. This powdery substance helps plants reproduce, but it can also trigger itchy eyes and stuffy noses. People with allergies should check pollen forecasts and limit outdoor time during high levels, says the CDC. That's what they do. They put out stuff like that. Cities such as Atlanta, Georgia, and Houston, Texas, have already broken spring pollen records this year. That's according to the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. Studies suggest that warming global temperatures may be a cause. More pollen is released, lengthening the spring allergy season. Next article, in Time for Kids, sticking with that. Passing of a Pope. Maybe you heard about this. Let's see, they didn't say who wrote this. The Time staff, Time magazine. Pope Francis passed away at the age of 88 on April 21st. The Vatican said Francis died after a stroke. It was one day after his Easter Sunday appearance at Vatican City's St. Peter's Square in Rome, Italy. He bestowed well wishes on thousands of supporters. Born Jorge Maria Bergoglio, Francis was elected pope in 2013. He was the first Latin American pope. Time named him Person of the Year and wrote that his election signaled great change. During his term, Francis became known for his kindness and his calls for global peace. Francis's death begins a leadership transition going on right now, a transition period there. It is at the Vatican. Picking a new pope is no easy task. The election is organized in a process known as a conclave. A group of about 120 cardinals will gather to vote in the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. It typically takes 2 to 3 weeks to assemble the group members. They must travel to Vatican City from all over the world. The cardinals will swear an oath of secrecy. Each will put his choice for pope on a paper ballot and carry it to an altar, dropping it in a large chalice. Multiple rounds of voting may occur. A white puff of smoke in St. Peter's Square will announce that a new pope has been elected. And we'll do one more article here in Time for Kids. Worth the Fight. Who did this one? Time for Kid reporter Milo Bouchon wrote this little article here. Some things are really worth fighting for. That's what Ben Wang's character learns in the sixth movie in the Karate Kid franchise. There were six of them. Wang plays Li Fong. in Karate Kid's Legends. Lee, a kung fu prodigy, moves from China to New York City after a family tragedy. He has given up fighting, but a school bully pushes him to defend himself. This sounds familiar. Later, Lee decides to compete against the bully in a citywide karate contest. With the help of his two mentors, Lee learns karate and manages it with his kung fu knowledge. Wang says that Lee's relationship with his mentors, Mr. Han, played by Jackie Chan, and Daniel LaRusso, that's Ralph Macchio, came back for this, are just as important to the story as fighting. His co-stars served as mentors both on screen and off, and he says, "Learning anything is 100 times easier if you have a good teacher." Okay, let's go over to Science News. Science News Explores. Wiggling ears may have once helped boost human hearing, but an ancient ear-moving muscle probably aren't all that helpful to us today. Laura Sanders wrote this article. You've probably seen a cat or dog swing their ears toward the sound. We can't move our fairly rigid ears this dramatically, but people still possess ancient ear-moving muscles. Some of us can even wiggle our ears on demand. And it turns out, they're more active than anyone knew. Who is this? Andreas Schroer. Schroer, there it is an ear muscle expert, an ear wiggler himself. He's also a neuroscientist at Saarland University, that's in Saarbrücken, Germany. Schroer was part of a team that asked 20 people with normal hearing to listen to a recorded voice. Meanwhile, distracting podcasts played in the background. Electrodes around the volunteers' ears recorded their muscle activity. One particular muscle fired up when listening conditions were difficult. It is known as the superior auricular muscle. It sits just above the ear and lifts it up. Millions of years ago, this muscle may have helped our ancestors home in on sounds. But modern humans don't wiggle their ears all that much. Today, it's doubtful that this tiny wisp of muscle action helps us hear better, though scientists haven't tested that, says Schroer. It does its best, but it probably doesn't work. Still, these muscles might have another use. Their activity could provide a measure of someone's effort to hear. That knowledge might one day be used to help improve hearing aid technology. For instance, it might tell the device to dampen background noise when someone is struggling to hear. Schroer says that humans' wide variety of ears and wiggling abilities possess a challenge for research on ear muscles. And ear muscles' wide range of sizes, he adds, can make it hard to accurately record their activity. Schroer has collected stories of remarkable ear abilities. These include people who feel their ears moving toward a sound. Others use their ear movements in daily life. They just wiggle their ears a little bit, and then their glasses are back on their nose where they belong, he says. Ear wiggling research is comforting to some people with exceptional ear control, Schroer says. They really appreciate it because they always thought they were kind of strange. Next article. Sticking with Science News Explorers. Let's learn about memory, shall we? Brain cell connections underlie this ability to recall facts and reminisce about the past. Maria Temming wrote this article. Think about a fact you recently had to memorize for a test, or a song that's been stuck in your head, or how you felt when you last hung out with a friend. All the sights, sounds, and other sensations those words brought to mind are memories, experiences and information your brain has filed away. These stored data play a huge role in how what we understand the world, our relationships, and the people in it and ourselves. But how does the brain make memories? When you experience something, brain cells called neurons send each other signals. Those electrical pulses zip through links between neurons called synapses. The more often you experience something, the more often certain sets of neurons will talk to each other. And the more they talk, the stronger the links between them become. Scientists generally think those neural circuits encode memories, though some research has shown that other types of brain cells may play a role too. One recent study showed that sparse yet strong links between neurons in the hippocampus, the brain's memory center, maximize info storage. Several factors can get in the way of a brain's ability to retain information. Injuries such as concussions can make it harder to remember stuff. Marijuana use has also been linked to foggier memories in younger people. Frequent multitasking, too, seems to get in the way of recall, even when you're trying to focus on one thing at a time. On the flip side, there are many ways to boost memory. If you're studying for a test, quizzing yourself and looking at pictures can help you hold on to information. Writing by hand rather than typing also seems to help. If you want to improve your memory more generally, exercise is useful. It increases blood flow to the brain. So is eating a healthy diet that feeds the brain much-needed nutrients. Next article here. On Bigler's World. It's Bigler's World. It's Bigler's World. Let's do a thing on exoskeletons. This armor protects insects, spiders, and more. Katie Grace Carpenter wrote this particular article. An exoskeleton is an armor-like covering that protects many small invertebrates. Such animals include insects, spiders, and crustaceans. The prefix exo means outside, so an exoskeleton is basically a skeleton worn on the outside of a body. This is in contrast to skeletons that some animals, such as humans, have inside their bodies. And I like that arrangement a little better. Like our internal skeletons, other creatures' outer skeletons have joints. They also attach to animals' ligaments and tendons. This allows them to move. The exoskeletons of most insects are made up of a polymer called chitin, C-H-I-T-I-N. Some crustaceans harden their chitin exoskeletons with minerals. Calcium salts strengthen exoskeletons of lobsters and crabs. That's why we must use tools to crack open hard crab shells. The shells of clams and snails are almost all calcium salts and minerals. Exoskeletons provide lots of protection. They also help animals retain water. The exoskeleton creates a barrier between the animal's insides and its surroundings, and this reduces evaporation. But these benefits come with trade-offs. One downside, is extra weight. Outer armor is typically heavier than bones that would be needed to support the same animal. And the stronger an exoskeleton is, the heavier it will be. Also, exoskeletons generally do not grow with the animal. Animals must shed their outgrown armor before they can grow a better fitting set. This process is called molting, and it can be dangerous. During this time, an animal may be very vulnerable to predators, and sometimes an animal cannot shed its old skin properly. This can be deadly. After molting, the animal's new exoskeleton usually takes time to harden. Still, the perks of nature's armor have inspired scientists to mimic it in new technology. For example, exoskeleton suits might help astronauts walk on the moon. Next article. Sticking with science news, they got a lot of good stuff in this particular week. Can this woolly mouse help bring back extinct mammoths? I got a picture of it here. It's pretty woolly looking. New work on de-extinction. That's a new term. De-extinction shows promise in little animals, but may prove harder for big ones, says Jason Bittel, who wrote this article. Scientists are working to unlock the secrets to bring back extinct animals. One potentially important new advance is the creation of genetically altered mice with long, golden locks of tufted fur. They were, in fact, inspired by the coats of woolly mammoths. The new rodents are being called colossal woolly mice, and yes, they are super cute. As transgenic mice, their genes have been tweaked by engineering. That in itself is not all that special. What's notable here is that 8 spots have been edited across 7 genes. The team did 3 experiments, each used a different mix of edits. In all, they created 32 woolly mice, each varied slightly in appearance. All, however, carried the hoped-for traits, notes Beth Shapiro, an evolutionary biologist. She works at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's also chief science officer at the Colossal Biosciences in Dallas, Texas. There she was part of a team working on the new mice. Their gene editing worked well, Shapiro says. They got seemingly healthy animals with some mammoth-like traits. There were also no surprises, she says, other than that they were so absolutely adorable. Her team described its achievements in a paper posted March 4th at biorxiv.org. That bio prescription, I don't know. So what can we expect when it comes to bringing back extinct species? Well, Colosso Biosciences founder Ben Lamb said he wants woolly mammoth calves on the ground by the year 2028. Can they achieve that? I don't know. I'll read on. They'll start by tweaking Asian elephants' genes to be more mammoth-like. Later, they'll need to put mammoth-like embryos into another animal, likely an elephant, to serve as each calf's mom. Says Shapiro, we will have elephant cells that are edited and ready to go in early 27. That's what we would need to have calves on the ground in 2028. However, she adds, there's a lot of hard biology that still hasn't been solved. And before those calves are actually born, that needs to be solved. So what is a woolly mouse exactly? To create the woolly mouse, scientists analyzed all the genetic instructions, or genomes, in 121 tissue samples from mammoths and elephants. The goal here was to find the genes that might have given woolly mammoths some of their key traits. Those include long, thick, golden hair. They also include genes for absorbing and using fat, important features for animals that lived in bitter cold, says Shapiro. We can do a lot with the mammoth genomes we have. We can line them up on a computer and compare them to elephant genomes. In this way, her team compiled where all the mammoth genes are the same as each other, but different from their elephant cousins. Those differences pointed to what should make a mammoth a mammoth. The researchers then selected for similar traits in mice. Those could be in naturally occurring genes or in ones that might be added through genetic engineering. Mice are much easier to work with than elephants. The tiny rodents require little space. They also breed quickly. And being extensively studied, their genes are already well understood. For instance, scientists have known since 1994 that mice will grow much longer hair than usual if you turn off a gene known as FGF5. Similarly, a gene known as MC1R makes mice blonde, and if gene FRZD makes that hair warry and frizzled. You're looking woolly to me. The final step in creating the new woolly mice, editing embryos' genes to help them become living, breathing, gloriously furred mice. They're still a long way from mammoths, the next section says. This gene tweaking worked with high efficiency. In other words, the scientists not only made woolly mice, but could do so reliably and repeatedly. And that's actually a big deal, says Shapiro. Of course, mice are not elephants, she acknowledges. Indeed, it's something critics have often pointed out to us, she adds. That's why she says these woolly mice are just one part of her team's de-extinction goal. Colosso Biosciences started way back in 2021, has also been experimenting directly with Asian elephant cells. The reason, that species is related most closely to extinct woolly mammoths. Another arm of the company's research focuses on techniques to improve artificial reproduction. These are skills that will be needed to implant a genetically modified elephant embryo into a living elephant, one that would ultimately give birth to a mammoth calf. In related work, this team is also working on efforts to bring back the extinct dodo and the, so we can pronounce this, thylacine. The last animal, also known as the Tasmanian wolf, was actually a wolf-like marsupial. We can't just clone woolly mammoths. Jacqueline Gill is an Ice Age ecologist. She works at the University of Maine in Orono. Gill doesn't hide her excitement about the idea of one day seeing a real live woolly mammoth. She says, I understand why someone would be compelled to see a mammoth, she says, in much the way she explains, I've never seen the Ice Age in person, right? It only exists in my mind's eye because I study the past that is gone. She does not reject the idea of trying to bring back extinct species. In fact, Gill says, the science of de-extinction is exciting and has broad applications. She is skeptical, however, that what Colosso Biosciences is working on will qualify as bringing a woolly mammoth back from the dead. For starters, many well-preserved mammoth remains have been discovered in permafrost. In some cases, they were complete carcasses with fur, muscles, and skin. However, they also had been buried in ice for thousands of years, and that likely destroyed every cell in those remains. Without intact cells, researchers won't be able to clone a mammoth as easily as some in the past had cloned sheep. That's a whole pathway to cloning that is cut off from us. Wait a minute, that's the wrong accent. Gene adapting may allow researchers to alter an Asian elephant in ways to make it resemble a woolly mammoth, but any effort to do so will likely miss untold genetic traits that made woolly mammoths unique as a species. Keep in mind, emphasizes Tori Herridge, she says, a mammoth is not an elephant in a fur coat. An evolutionary biologist, she works at the University of Sheffield in England. Mammoth doubts abound. Herridge does find the idea of identifying candidates' genes for mammoth fur and cold adaptation really exciting and interesting. Still, she cautions, we don't know what makes a mammoth a mammoth. We all know that genes are complicated, she says. One gene can affect many things, and many genes can act together. What's more, she points out, researchers don't yet know if genes for hair length, texture, or color in the woolly mice will produce the same effects in Asian elephants. Some work can be done in the test lab, Shapiro says. For instance, her team is already growing elephant cells in a lab dish. They can then test how those cells respond to things like possible changes in how or where the tissue, the gene, is active. This allows Colossal to learn more about which genes to target without having to grow or experiment each time on a whole new elephant. The team has already created elephant stem cells. These are the pluripotent type. That means they could potentially be used to create any type of cell, from skin to heart to bone or brain. That's the key step towards assisting reproduction of an animal, with the goal of one day moving a gene-edited elephant embryo into an elephant to serve as its surrogate mother. Complicating this last step is the fact that pregnancy in Asian elephants can last almost 2 years. So taking each gene-edited elephant embryo to birth in such a surrogate would take far, far longer than bringing forth a woolly mouse. After all, the mouse's pregnancy lasts just 18 to 21 days. Another possible complication, the International Union for Conservation of Nature classifies Asian elephants as endangered with extinction, so the species' rarity could limit anyone's permission to use it for surrogate mom. For her part, Shapiro remains optimistic that something like this de-extinction is possible. In fact, one of her company's other projects might succeed first, bringing back the dodo. After all, she notes, it lays eggs. That means it doesn't need a surrogate mother. And with that, I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.